Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Let me read you a few headlines today before I introduce my guest. We're talking about occupied Palestine again. These headlines could be any day, every day, but here's a few. This is what life in occupied Palestine is like. This comes from the International Middle East Media Center. In pre-dawn raids, the Israeli military kidnaps 8 Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. They have no idea what's going on. The military breaks into their homes, hauls them away, no charges, sends them off to detention, and then maybe to a prison where they're not treated particularly well. Is that ever an understatement? Here's another one. Infant dies in Gaza due to the Israeli siege. The death toll reaches 337 since Gaza was placed under siege nearly 2 years ago. Here's another one. A youth wounded near Tubas probably was doing nothing. A soldier wasn't happy about something and just shot the person. Here's another one. Man loses leg after being shot at checkpoint on Saturday. Again, soldier was a little irritated over what, who knows, and instead of saying something, shot the person. The man lost his leg. I could keep going. There's one after another, after another, after another, and it's the same thing every single day. And then just one more, and then we'll get on with the program. An EU convoy called a Hope Convoy was trying to get through the Rafah border crossing from Egypt into Gaza, and the Egyptians wouldn't allow it to come in. Well, it was carrying humanitarian aid, medical supplies, other needed things for people who need it desperately. The Egyptian authorities, working with Washington and Israel, would not allow it to enter. Well, maybe one day it would, another day it won't. This is what life in occupied Palestine is like. And the West Bank is under siege. I'm sorry, Gaza is under siege, but the West Bank is very, very heavily oppressed as well. My guest today is Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer teaches at the University of Wisconsin, and she's also the director, the associate director of its Middle East Studies program. She's also a board member of the Israeli Coalition Against House Demolitions, the USA branch, and she's founder of the Madison Rafa Sister City Project, and she's also a freelance journalist. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful having you back. We last spoke just a few days after Operation Cast Lead supposedly ended, and your comments were very important. We can continue with what's going on now. And just today on Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, oh, there's some frightening stuff. I don't know whether you took a look at it. I can mention a couple of things.
Yes.
Did you see it today?
Yeah, I glanced through it this morning.
Oh, my goodness, plus whatever else is on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
But two things that struck me from Haaretz was Israel's foreign minister, oh, dear, that music means we need to take a break.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Let's take a brief break, and we'll come back, and then we'll get into this and the things that are on your mind, Jennifer. Such a big issue for the two of us. We have to keep at it.
Yep.
We'll be right back. Cascadia Public Radio. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jennifer Lowenstein. We're talking about occupied Palestine. Jennifer, very briefly, the article about Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, I refer to as a psychopath and a fascist. wanting all Israeli citizens to swear a loyalty oath to the state of Israel as a Jewish Zionist state and require them to serve either in the Israeli military or perform national service, some other form of national service, and those who don't do it or refuse to do it revoke their citizenship, which for Palestinians would mean deporting them, expelling them from Israel.
Well, these are all techniques that have been, you know, used or tried before. I think what lies behind it is part of a process that was begun before 1947, and that is to remove the Palestinian population from the historic land of Palestine. This is something that I see in the continuum of that. And, you know, the sad thing is that so many people see the history of Israel-Palestine in segments, and I tend to see it as a continuing process that has worsened in many ways over the years, and that will continue to worsen until Palestinian society is entirely destroyed, unless Western public opinion can put pressure on their governments. And I think that we are better placed to do that today than we have been at any time. I think Operation Cast Lead was a big PR hit for Israel, and in the sense of it bringing very bad PR to Israel. And I sense that people are becoming less and less patient with Israeli occupation, with their policies, their tactics against civilians. And yet we have a government that is very much, I see it as consistent with what we've had up until now, including with the Bush administration. I don't see Obama as a break with that past.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. There was a great article that James Petras wrote, and he comes on this program on a pretty regular basis. He wrote an article about Obama calling him the first Jewish president.
Mm-hmm.
That, he went back and he just reviewed what went on long before he ever became a candidate, that he was vetted through the Chicago political system by the politicians, by the Jewish community. And there was a little disagreement, but I think the overwhelming feeling was that this guy is safe. We can move him up the ranks.
Sorry, but it's interesting to me to see the media reports, both in this country and in Israel, talking about the potential antipathy or clash between the Netanyahu administration and the Obama administration over issues such as settlements and the two-state solution. I see this as almost purely semantic. I hope that I'm wrong. I hope to be proven wrong. But so far, I hear a lot of noise coming out of people in Washington, but I don't see any action. And in the meantime, there are 6,000 or so residents of East Jerusalem poised to lose their homes, if not more. And while there are people in Washington who say, as Hillary Clinton did in her most memorable words, that this is unhelpful, you know, the point is that we're not doing anything. We're not really putting any pressure on the Israelis to stop.
Oh, exactly true, Jennifer. And this has gone on for at least the past 40-odd years. And if listeners wonder why every single U.S. government, it doesn't matter whether it's Republican or Democrat, in some respects the Democrats give more than the Republicans. I think George Bush gave more than most Republicans.
I think George Bush was pretty much hands-off Israel for the first 7 years of his rule. I mean, he was an abysmal president. He's got a record of war crimes that easily outdoes the record of Saddam Hussein and others. But he didn't really start to engage with the Palestine issue until last year, until the Annapolis conference, which was a complete farce. With Obama and with other Democrats, including Clinton, we see much more engagement with the process, but that engagement translates itself into greater support for Israel. And this comes out in media reports. It comes out in policy actions. You had remarked on how people are basically kidnapped in the middle of the night in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip on an almost daily basis. And that reminded me of the story of the Lebanon War in the summer of 2006, when media all over Western Europe and the United States blamed Hezbollah for starting that war because it crossed the border into Israel, which was indeed against international law, and kidnapped or captured Israeli soldiers. This was something that was absolutely inexcusable, unforgivable. The Israelis therefore had a right to go into Lebanon to destroy a huge part of its infrastructure, killing more than 1,000 civilians. But then we find out, curiously, for those of us who try to read beyond what gets into the New York Times and the Washington Post, that the day before those Israeli soldiers were captured, two Palestinian civilians, two brothers in Gaza, were spirited out of the Gaza Strip by undercover Israeli agents, taken to an unknown destination. We still don't know whether they're dead or alive. And it got barely a sentence in the major papers anywhere. But see, since they're Palestinian, they don't count. They're Untermenschen. They're people whose lives are unimportant. So when Israeli soldiers or people who are trained militarily to represent the government and its policies against Lebanon, against Syria, against Iraq, when these people are captured, it becomes a worldwide scandal, as was the capture of Gilad Shalit. But when day after day after day, Palestinian civilians are kidnapped from their homes in the middle of the night or the middle of the day, whatever it is, taken away, disappeared, as it were, nobody bats an eyelash.
It never gets a single mention in the major U.S. media. It's just like the tree that falls in the forest, Jennifer. No one hears it, no one sees it, so it never happened.
Ask how many people, when you're talking to somebody in the next few days, about the Israel-Palestine conflict. Ask whoever it is you're speaking to if they heard of the Muammar brothers, if they know who the Muammar brothers are. Then ask if they know who Gilad Shalit is. Almost certainly they'll know who Gilad Shalit is because, you know, the Western press has been focusing on him with such attention for the last 3 years that it's hard not to know who he is. But the Muammar brothers, the two people kidnapped from Gaza in broad daylight the day before the Lebanon War began, nobody ever heard of them.
And it's more than just two, Jennifer. It's
of
two.
Course.
It's two. It's many hundreds. It's many thousands. And this goes back year after year after year after year. Barely a day goes by.
It's so depressing because it's not just it's a combination of disappearing people, of using methods of torture, of having secret detention facilities within Israel, of having Palestinian prisoners kept in prisons within Israel, which is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And it's a matter of kidnapping both civilians and activists, as well as a legally elected government. I remember being in Jerusalem in the summer of 2006, and I had lined up a number of interviews with members of the new Palestinian Legislative Council, Hamas members, and the morning that I was going off to conduct these interviews, I turned the news on only to find that they'd all been rounded up and arrested in a sting operation the night before. So, and most of them are still there. You have about two-thirds of the legally elected representatives of the last Palestinian election in jail. And you have the radical fringe of Fatah, as I call it, collaborating entirely with the Israelis because of their own inner antipathy, their own internal problems with Hamas. It's very ugly. It's very ugly politics. And it's something most people here don't have any idea about.
Oh, they don't, Jennifer. I call the Fatah government an illegitimate government. It has an elected president, Muammar Abbas, that his term expired on January 9th,
yes.
And he stays in office, and he won't leave.
And, of course, he's made legitimate by the United States.
Oh, of course.
Whereas the legally elected and fair, democratic, transparent, accountable elections, whereas the Hamas party members who were elected in 2006 are completely, they're rendered invisible. We won't talk to them. We won't acknowledge them. And this is somehow going to help the situation. I don't understand the logic of that. If anything, it's going to increase extremism in Palestine. It already has. Hamas was never elected because the majority of people who voted for it were Hamas ideologues. They were elected because these people were tired of Fatah not delivering. They decided they would give Hamas a chance to see if they had any better luck. It had nothing to do with the population turning into rabid Islamists, who follow a creed like Al Qaeda. That's myth. There's no particle of truth in that.
Well, exactly.
But this is what we're given to believe.
We have to take another break, Jennifer. Hamas was never that way, and back in the 1980s, Israel supported Hamas against the PLO and Yasser Arafat.
Part of its divide and conquer.
Oh, divide and conquer, exactly. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jennifer Lowenstein. We're talking about occupied Palestine. Oh, so many points that we both can raise, Jennifer. One is that Israel needs to justify what it does, so it needs conflict. I once quoted something that former Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said in the 1980s when things had quieted down too much, and Arafat was really seeking a pretty peaceful negotiations, which along the way he decided he wanted to do. And Shamir complained that there was a serious problem, a political one. Things were too quiet because Israel needs to instigate violence so it can blame the Palestinians to justify what it does, because you've got these dangerous people around you. So you need to take action to protect your people. It's all a sham.
It's all part of this continuum that I was speaking of earlier, in which the Israeli state opted for expansionism over peace way back in 1947 with the partition resolution and the subsequent independence war, as it's called. Unfortunately, this has been going on for a long time. What you were speaking of Yitzhak Shamir, but of course one can go back much farther than with him. If you look at the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, we had a similar situation where, first of all, an Israeli diplomat was assassinated in London by an organization that had absolutely nothing to do with the PLO, and this was used as the pretext for invading Lebanon and destroying or hoping to destroy the PLO. And the purpose of doing that was to pacify the West Bank, to clamp down on grassroots resistance within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Of course, none of this was publicized in the press because the story, the party line, was that Israel invaded Lebanon because of PLO attacks into Israel from Lebanese territory. Well, if you actually look at the record carefully, you find out that the PLO had abided by a ceasefire for quite some time, and that this was very irritating to the Israelis because they needed a pretext to go in and get the PLO out of Beirut. So they did. They, in the same way that the Americans managed to link Saddam Hussein with Al-Qaeda, the Israelis managed to link some lunatic who wasn't related to the PLO, as if he was a full-blown member, and this became a pretext for war. And then, as I said, for the greater goal of pacifying the West Bank, of keeping it quiet and subdued so there wouldn't be any protests and demonstrations when greater settlements were built and more land expropriated and more resources used for settlers and for Israelis, while the Palestinian lands are carved up into these little islands or cantons, where it becomes increasingly difficult to exist on a day-to-day basis. There's no planning. Every time I speak to friends, whether they're in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, I'm reminded of this, that one cannot plan a wedding, a trip, a visit to a sick family member, or to go to school, because one never knows from a day-to-day, let alone hour-to-hour basis, if they will get across a checkpoint, if a certain gate will be open, if a road will be closed, if there will be a curfew. You're off balance. You're kept off balance all the time. And this has a psychological effect on the population of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. People have absolutely no sense of security either in a national sense, national state security, or in a personal, very intimate sense. You wipe away the sense of security, and what do you get? You get a nation that is falling in upon itself, and that's absolutely no surprise. It certainly accounts for a great deal of the internal factional fighting between Fatah and Hamas. Most Palestinians know full well, for example, that if there's not some kind of national unity government in a very short period of time, the Israeli project of destroying Palestinian society is going to be fulfilled. And yet, these internal conflicts are both exacerbated by Israeli actions and American support, as well as by internal conflict and this total lack of security.
Oh, indeed so, Jennifer. Palestine is under military occupation. I don't think anybody in the U.S. has any idea what that really means. I have never been to occupied Palestine, and even though I've read so much about it, I've written so much about it, I discuss it so often in this program, I know that without seeing it and living under it, there's no way to really understand what people go through on a day-to-day basis. What you say, the things that we take for granted in this country, my goodness, just crossing town to visit a neighbor or a friend.
You don't know if you're going to have power to run your internet or to water to drink or heat for your apartment in the middle of winter. There's absolutely no way of planning. One of the consequences of this, by the way, is the increased fertility rate.
We need a break again.
Yes. I'll come back to that.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm on with Jennifer Lowenstein, talking about occupied Palestine. Let me let you pick up, Jennifer, from where you left off.
Yes, I was going to make a comment about the recent Lancet special series on health and medical services under occupation. This was an issue that came out this past March, the first comprehensive study ever done on health and medicine under the Israeli occupation. And there were many interesting findings. There were many areas that were looked into. One of the things I thought most interesting of all was the fact that we know that in Gaza the birth rate is very high, and higher than in many other third world countries. And in studying this factor, what the researchers found is that when you take away personal security to the extent that the occupation has taken it away from an entire population, one of the consequences is that the birth rate goes up, because you go back to a time when the only security that you had was in the number of children you had. In other words, this is your only capital, is your family. These are the only, this is the only material thing, you know, human beings, children, that are going to guarantee any kind of continuity, any kind of safety whatsoever. I think that was a very interesting finding, and it tells you just how devastating the conditions are that, you know, people have, they're being forced almost back in time to live in a society where you have to depend on your children to, you know, the more children you have, the more secure you are as a family, where actually a corollary to that is the infant mortality rate, which has basically stalled, whereas in most countries it has gone down. You know, there are where you people don't have, they can't rely on getting proper medical care if they get seriously ill. There aren't the medicines in the Gaza Strip in particular to rely on. They don't have the health facilities to take care of people. People can't get permits to get out to go to hospitals in Egypt or in other countries. It's scandalous. It's absolutely scandalous what we are standing by and watching without very much comment, I'm sorry to say. These are crimes against humanity and war crimes, combination of both. And they're going on day by day as Israel refuses, for example, to let in medical aid convoys, construction material, building material for houses, homes, school supplies, medicines, water and electricity don't function properly. The sewage system is a catastrophe. You know, how do we face ourselves in the morning knowing that this is happening because of the amount of support and funding we're giving Israel?
I think, but of course, we do the same thing every way, Jennifer. We're doing it in Afghanistan. We're doing it in Iraq.
In Colombia.
Oh, in Colombia. Either where we are an occupying power in two countries, or where we use proxies. So we use proxies in Colombia, in Somalia, in numerous other countries. And on top of this, oh, I mean, we could go on this. We circle the globe with something that may exceed 1,000 military bases. Nobody really knows, because some of them are secret, some of them are shared. And the idea is to literally solidify hegemonic control over the entire planet. It's a subject that we'll be discussing on a future program, all from a number of aspects. But so this country...
Well, and it feeds into this whole issue of Hamas. I've argued before that if Hamas didn't exist, Israeli policy would be identical to what it is today. Because what the Israeli state cannot tolerate is resistance on any level to its policies of expansion and land grabbing, resource grabbing. It doesn't matter whether it's Hamas or a secular Arab nationalist group that's in power. The policies of the Israeli government would be the same. Hamas is just a convenient foil. We like to, you know, identify Islam with terrorism, and terrorism with an existential threat to Israel, which, of course, is also never questioned, but utterly bogus when you realize that Israel is a regional superpower and the fourth most powerful military in the world. But these myths are recycled over and over and over again to the point where they're recited by students in, for example, classes that I teach. You realize the student has never once questioned this truth, this truism that they've been taught since they were capable of thinking. And, you know, such as, well, if Israel is the victim, Since when does the victim have the greater military strength? Since when does the victim occupy 4 million people and keeping them literally imprisoned in their own lands? Since when does the victim prevent school children from going to school, from having adequate nutrition, from having having basic medical care available to them? I mean, these are the perversion of logic is so it's so distorted, and yet it still goes unquestioned in so many circles. And it's amazing to me how visceral the responses are when the subject of Israel-Palestine comes up among people who are pro-Israel. I hate that label, but that's, you know, people who support the policies of Israel. You know, there's an almost hysteria attached to any criticism, you know, minor critique of some kind of policy is taken as some kind of a sacrilegious act, to the point where, whether you're in the classroom or not, you have to be careful. And this is, of course, another theme playing out today in this country, where faculty members across the United States, tenured and non-tenured, have to worry about getting on a list and being blacklisted, having their students spy on them, taking dubious notes about what they're saying and spreading these lies on the internet. I've seen it again and again. And this is the response of a lobby that cannot allow itself to be critiqued publicly, because if it were, the people who are listening would wake up. And that was part of the damage of Cast Lead. Many people who don't really understand very much about Gaza or the West Bank or the fact that they're part of the same nation saw limited pictures on television, especially in this country, and started to ask, well, you know, this doesn't seem right. Why would Israel bomb the UNRWA compound in Gaza City, which is full of sacks of food? Is an accident? Don't tell me that's an accident. I used to live across the street from it, the size of a whole city block. The precision weapons couldn't tell that this was an UNRWA compound. It's utter nonsense. The Israelis knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew why they were doing it. But we don't allow this out in public discussion to the extent that it should be allowed out. And the reason is because if it's found out to be what it is, which is a pack of lies generated to maintain regional hegemony by Israel and global hegemony by the United States, then you have people in your own country starting to question what you're up to, and you can't keep doing it.
We don't have enough people questioning. We need more media like this. I'm one program. We need many programs like this. We need people going to these sources to find out what's really going on. When you control the means of communication, Jennifer, the major media getting the big audiences, the educational system, where literally people are taught myths from the earliest level in innocent ways, all the way up to the highest levels. In the building I live in Chicago, I'm surrounded by very, very smart people who mostly are abysmably ignorant. It is astonishing. People who should know better, doctors, lawyers, accountants, some academics.
But they don't want to know better. They have no excuse for not knowing better. When you're educated and you have access to information at your fingertips, there's no excuse for not knowing better.
Exactly.
So I find, you know, and the myths that you were speaking about in the schools, I certainly don't see them as innocent. I think that you didn't mean it in the sense that I took it. But the fact of the matter is, I think it's a little bit strange that more primary and secondary school children know about the Nazi Holocaust than they do about the American Civil War. I think it's scandalous that there's a Holocaust museum in Washington, D.C., when there are barely the very beginnings of memorials to the genocide of the Native Americans. You know, which crime is worse in American history, the Holocaust? I mean, what's there's obviously some political motivation behind this that people aren't questioning, or at least not enough people are questioning. And what's happened, of course, is that you're turning, I believe that we are creating the conditions for something like a new anti-Semitism, because you find more and more people disgusted by the very word Holocaust, because it's used in the most ugly and opportunistic ways. You know, I can't stand to turn on a program about the Nazi Holocaust. I automatically assume that it is going to be propaganda, and that's what many people are assuming.
Oh, it is propaganda.
It is.
And of course, it's Holocaust with a capital H, like there's something especially unique about the Jewish Holocaust, almost like no other's ever happened. But in that same war, World War II, that millions of Jews died, whatever the number was. Nobody really knows what the exact number was, but millions died. At the same time, maybe 20 million Slavs died at the hands of the Nazis, including Jews.
Well, and it's disturbing. I certainly believe that every Holocaust, every attempt at genocide, has unique elements to it. In the Nazi Holocaust, the unique element was the methodology, the systematic, industrialized mass killing. Very, very, ominous how it was used. But to somehow make that the measure of all evil, or to allow people to use the Nazi Holocaust to give them what's called legal power of attorney to undercut anybody else's suffering is sickening.
It's assembly line genocide or slow motion genocide, as I like to call it, Jennifer, genocide is genocide. In his writings about Native Americans, Ward Churchill talks about over maybe 400 years or so, as many as 100 million Native Americans, meaning all of the Americas, were destroyed. That is a real genocide. Well, it didn't happen in half a dozen years or a dozen years. It happened over hundreds of years. But we're talking about maybe 100 million people, and you can only estimate it. Nobody knows. But it was the systematic slaughter of Native people so that other people who came here from another part of the world...
For a colonial settler state.
Exactly.
What this country is and exactly what Israel is. That's what one thing we share in common. And it is scandalous that American school children across the country don't know the extent to which their forebears, for the most part, had a role in wiping out the indigenous population of this country. We don't know about it. We're not taught about it, and we don't. Instead, we carry on these myths of the founding fathers and their enlightened ideals, and the city on the hill that's, you know, glowing from afar, exceptional in all ways, and trying to bring freedom and democracy to the world. People buy into this myth, as you were saying before. Educated, intelligent, professional people buy into this myth. And I wonder very often whether it isn't on purpose, because it's too inconvenient to challenge it. Once you challenge it, you have to change your entire way of thinking. You have to suddenly decide that you have to suddenly be faced with the fact that the United States has been the principal supporter of world terror for well over the last 60 years. It backs all of the most egregious and horrible atrocities that have taken place, a huge number of them the roots of them could be found here, the source of them are here, whether it's Chile or Colombia or, Bosnia, whatever. You find that the Western powers, that this kind of expansion, the need for hegemony over a particular region is fueling it.
Well, what we've done, Jennifer, as you know, goes back to the very beginning, and even before this nation became a nation. But the real coming out, really, we came out in stages. World War One was part of the coming out. Before that, the Spanish War, the so-called Spanish-American War.
We had a manifest destiny. We had a destiny to occupy, to colonize, and to wipe out the people who lived here before us. And when we get on our high horse and talk about Iran not being allowed to have nuclear weapons, I find it so hypocritical that I am as opposed to any country having nuclear weapons as any person could be. And yet I can't stand to hear the United States preaching to Iran about how it is not allowed to enrich uranium and mustn't ever make nuclear weapons. Which country has used nuclear weapons on civilian populations? Which country has used chemical and biological weapons on civilian populations? We have.
Well,
Hiroshima,
we know
Nagasaki, Vietnam, Agent Orange, Napalm. The number of examples are frightening.
Oh, it goes on and on. And today we use depleted uranium, which is spreading radiation over vast areas, affecting our own forces as well as the people who live in the areas under attack. Those bombs that we use, so far we're the only nation to have dropped atomic weapons on another nation. We not only did it, but we did it months after Japan had tried to surrender. They were willing to sacrifice everything. Everything. This is all documented. They wanted one thing only, their emperor. Truman turned them down flat, and then in August 1945, they surrendered officially, and they got what they wanted.
Yes.
We need to break again.
Mm-hmm.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jennifer Lowenstein. Jennifer, we're both so concerned about what's going on, and I think in one sense we can think of it as the strong wanting more strength, more power, more expansion, preying on the weak. Bullies usually don't attack equal bullies. They prey on the weak. They can dominate. They can defeat. So Palestinian civilians make a very easy target for the U.S.-Israeli alliance to attack, to destroy. It doesn't matter. International law is off the table. None of this matters. And it goes on and on and on and will go on. And I have to wonder right now, as you and I are on air together, whether the U.S.-Israeli alliance are planning their next war, maybe against Lebanon. There's an election coming up. If the wrong people win, then Lebanon again goes in the target zone.
Yes, I know.
That being Hezbollah, of course, part of the Lebanese government. So it could be another war against Lebanon as planned, certainly more conflict against Gaza, maybe the West Bank. And as we speak, these things are being planned right now.
It's scary. I think one of the things that is scary about it is that on a very concrete level, you have American military policymakers talking about surgical strikes and bombing underground, nuclear facilities in Iran, as if that this can be done in 3 or 4 days with very few civilian casualties, and then it's all done and over with, without taking into consideration how a people like the Iranian people are going to respond in the long run to such an attack, or without taking into consideration the regional implications of carrying out such an attack. There are Shia in Saudi Arabia who are increasingly alienated from the Saudi regime, who look more and more towards Iran and Iranian influence. Iraq is now governed primarily, although it's under occupation, the people who have come to Baghdad as the next leaders are all Shia. The United States definitely didn't plan that or want it. Some of the consequences that they got for invading a country on completely illegal ground. The point I'm making is that we have set ourselves up in such a way that the idea of making a limited surgical strike on a country like Iran to prevent it from getting nuclear weapons is absolutely foolish. The repercussions of such an act would be so profound and so widespread that I believe firmly it would be signaling the end of American dominance in the region. And we don't seem to see that, but here we have these Israeli and American hawks screeching about it and giving Iran timetables and talking about bunker-busting bombs that can, you know, take out underground facilities. This is all, there's something so sinister about it. You know, we forget that there's a human element there. We forget the repercussions this is going to have not only on civilians who will die, but on the neighboring states and the neighboring populations. How is this going to help Egypt? The Egyptian people don't support Hosni Mubarak, our puppet, any more than the Jordanian people are particularly supportive of their king, although there's slightly
indeed, Jennifer,
different.
That music means we've run out of time and they'll break away very shortly.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that attacking Iran would be an act of insanity, and in the end, I honestly don't think we'll do it. The entire Muslim world would explode if we do something like that.
Well, we can only hope.
We can only hope. There are some very unlevel heads in very important positions, and who knows what they'll do. But I just want to thank you so much for coming back on. We have to do this again.
Yes, thank you very much.
Oh, Jennifer, again, your comments...
We didn't even get to cast lead, and there was so much to be said about...